Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Escambia County against McMillan. Mr. Ryan, before you open your argument and before we start charging you for the time at the moment, we have before us a motion to dismiss this case by a majority of the present board. We deferred action on that until today. I would assume that you are not going to argue in support of that motion.
And, that is true.
Is it proposed that anyone present that motion in oral argument?
Mr. Santuri, who is a county counsel for Escambia County, is here, and I suppose if he wants to present it, he will be here to present it.
Very well, then you may proceed with your argument, and we'll determine later whether we will hear him.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan, in the same connection, there was a remedial order for which we granted certiorari to review. That's now been withdrawn, hasn't it?
Has what?
Been withdrawn.
Isn't
there a new plan at the district court order?
Yes, they have changed it.
What's before us, then, of the order that we...
The merits of the case.
How can it be if the order's not here?
I think the merits of the case now are both before you. But the court went right ahead.
If the order didn't have a stay. If the order is not here that we agreed to review, how are we going to review it?
Well, the order that you agreed to review was the merits of at-large elections under the Florida Constitution. And that is what I intend to present my argument and address it to now.
I have to say for myself, it strikes me that the whole thing is moot, or at least certainly premature.
Well, I would say that order is illegal, null and void, because the court that issued it had no jurisdiction to issue it. Now, Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. In this case, the appellee's claim is based upon a complaint that they have been denied access to the full and complete access to the at-large election system provided by the Florida Constitution and to the political process leading to the nominations and elections in the County Commission of Escambia County. I should have said that Escambia County is adjacent to Pensacola. It had 205,000 people in it in 1970, 233,000 in 1980. 19.7 of those are black. In 1970, 16.2% of them were eligible voters. In 1980, 17.2% were eligible voters. Of the eligible voters, 66.9% of the blacks are registered. 69.7% of the whites are registered. So there's on registration and on really participation in the electoral process, that way they're pretty equal. Now, first of all, in the second sentence of their brief, they say that they do not contend in this case, that any statute or any part of the Constitution has been invalidated. And so I address myself to jurisdiction. We are concerned here with the state constitution of Florida, over which Escambia has no control whatever. The state constitution requires at-large elections in non-charter counties, of which there are 62 and of which Escambia is one. In connection with that constitutional provision, they have also adopted an election system, which is about an inch thick, to carry out these elections. And so the requirement of at-large elections and the requirements for carrying it out are entirely state action. And so we raise the question as to whether or not the requirements of Article 3, Clause 2, or Section 2, Clause 1, of the Constitution has been met, because the real controversy here is not between Escambia and these people who claim they have been harmed by the at-large elections, which are put in, maintained, operated entirely by the state of Florida.
Mr. Ryan, I noticed that argument in your reply brief. I wonder, supposing the Florida had a statute that said no one except whites can vote, and suddenly a black citizen wanted to vote in Escambia and they didn't let him, and he sued the local officials. Could they do that?
Well, they once did have such a...
Well, but would they have standing to challenge a statewide statute if the local officials just said, we're not going to let you vote because the state law prohibits?
Well, I think
that
kind of a statute...
That'd be unconstitutional. Well, they contend this is. Maybe they're wrong, but your argument is that they must sue the governor and the legislature.
They must sue the... Well...
Why in this case and not the one I hypothesized?
What we have here is the controlling constitutional provision and statutes are all those of the state of Florida. And under the decisions of this court, you have got to prove that the injury that you claim can fairly be traced to the challenge action of the defendant and not traced to independent action by some other party. Now, you have independent action of some other party, the state of Florida here, that controls these at-large elections entirely. The county has absolutely nothing to do with them. The state prescribes them. The state carries them out.
Well, Mr. Ryan, supposing that the state of Florida had a one-year durational residence requirement in order to vote, which this court has held as unconstitutional, and someone went to Escambia County and registered to vote without having qualified for the 1 year and was told he couldn't register. Couldn't he sue the registrar in Escambia County claiming a denial of equal protection or whatever it is, right to travel, without joining the governor of Florida?
I think you'd have to join the state of Florida, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, because it is a Florida statute that is doing them the harm. Escambia's not doing anything to them.
I think a lot of our cases involving county officials where they've been defendants and charged with violating people's constitutional rights have involved them administering state statutes.
Well, it's involved them for this reason. Say, like in Rogers versus Lodge, you had special state statutes applicable only to Burke County. But this is a statewide constitutional provision.
Well, let's go to another case, the white primary case. Smith against Allwright was against two local county precinct judges, and it involved the primary law of the state of Texas. And nobody has ever questioned the jurisdiction until this day.
Well, Justice Marshall, they didn't administer the
Caprice
state statute.
Man
the,
one name,
the state
one
does.
Name, Liuza and the other one's name are all right. And they ended up by being fined $5 apiece.
Well,
but it was a state law which was declared unconstitutional.
Well,
in that case, and the governor not only was not a party, but when it came up here, the attorney general didn't even want to defend it.
Now, there is a federal statute, Justice Marshall, that requires that any judge before whom the constitutionality of a state statute or the Constitution is drawn in question, this 2403B, must notify the state attorney general
that this
is true so that he can be called, come
and
defend it.
He was notified and he said he didn't want to come.
Well,
and this court says come.
And
he did come.
Think that
but I mean,
that it's still a state
statute. It was
statute.
A state statute was involved. And it was a state statute that was declared unconstitutional.
Well, if the state causes...
And the precinct judges were found in per delicto and fined $5 apiece.
Mr. Wright, I suppose we say we study this out very carefully based on your brief. I'm very interested in listening to the merits of the case.
Well, I think also, Your Honor, this statement that no state statute or constitutional provision has been invalidated by the judgment below, which is the second sentence in their brief, is a statement that's very hard to defend.
Your central point, though, doesn't to turn on this subject, does it?
Court of Appeals, in about the third line of its decision, says that the lower court declared this constitution and statute unconstitutional, and then they affirmed it. So that statement is wrong. Now, the appellees, throughout their brief, have constantly claimed that it is Florida's constitution, it's that larger constitution, that has caused them damage. And statement after statement do they make in support of that claim. For example, 2 years after this case was filed, in their pretrial statement, they say that they're going to prove their case. Plaintiffs contend the evidence will show intentional, invidious racial discrimination by the state of Florida, not by Escambia, its officers and subdivisions, according to the following alternative standards.
Mr. Ryan, this argument, as I understand the response, goes only to whether this is a proper appeal or whether instead it's a certiorari. Again, it doesn't touch the merits of the case. I think all of us hope you'll get to the merits pretty soon.
All right. I will merely end my statement here about the constitutionality question and go to the merits. The aforesaid at-large election system carry forward and perpetuate the effects of past intentional devices employed by the state to discriminate against blacks. And so we say under those circumstances, under those conditions, this is Florida's constitution, this is Florida's statutes, and not Escambia's constitution, not Escambia's statutes, and that under Article 3, Section 2, Clause 1, the federal courts have no jurisdiction. With respect to the merits, I would first of all address myself to something that they make a lot of. in connection with the so-called referendum. I assume that, Mr. Justice Reynolds, that's what you have in mind. Now, the referendums were not suggested by the blacks or because there was any discrimination against them. They had had a referendum on whether or not to consolidate Pensacola and Escambia. That had been voted down. And so the commissioners of the city of Escambia sought ways and means of reforming and bringing up to date this whole area that's simply bursting at the seams. You have an enormous port there, the largest naval air station in the world, and they needed to reform their government. So they appointed a charter study committee of five, one of whom was a black, to draw up a new charter for the county of Escambia, as they had a right to do. And this charter committee worked for 2 years. And on the 20th of January, 1977, they reported that they were divided 3-2. They reported the majority, a plan of five commissioners being elected within districts and two at large, and in particular all the powers that all of these various local officers have to have. I've written a lot of these charters myself. You've seen a lot of them. Now, this charter by the majority was rejected by the minority on two major grounds. Number one, they said we don't need a charter. It's too costly and too complex. We don't need seven commissioners. Five is enough. They ought to be nonpartisan, elected within the districts. And so the commissioners then appointed another study committee of five. And that committee tried to put together the ideas of the two two dissenters and the three who were for this charter. And so they worked for 3 or 4 months and came up with a new charter. They recommended five elected with in districts. They put in there, the main thing they put in there, that this could never be used to consolidate Pensacola and Escambia. That seemed to be the major thing that bothered the people there then. And they also revised throughout the charter. And when they finished that revision, they called in their staff and had them go over it. And finally, by August, they were ready to go public, so to speak, with the results of the work on the charter. And so they announced that they were going to release a draft of this charter and publish it. They published it in the newspaper. They'd give out 15,000 copies to various clubs, study clubs, and things like that. They would then have eight public hearings. Now, let me stop here to say the big difference between this charter study committee and a charter commission under Florida law is a charter commission, you're required to have 11 to 15 members. They're supposed to work for 18 months and produce a charter unless the time is extended. And then when they hold three public hearings and they turn a charter in, the commissioners can't do anything about it. They can't change it at all. The commissioners here made tremendous changes in this charter, and one of them was to keep the five elected at large. Now, the other side pretends this was the big thing that was before the people in connection with the referendum, which they announced would take place on November 8th. They held these 8 hearings. They were shocked at the fact that only 15 or 20 people came out to the various hearings. At one of these hearings, 3 blacks did appear and say they wanted single-member districts, that blacks would get a fair deal if they had single-member districts than if they had elections at large. And so after discussion and advertising and all that kind of thing, and they finally adopted on the 14th of September a final draft, which was published in the newspapers and was given to anybody who wanted to study it. And that draft was voted on then in November and defeated. And so then we were into 1978, and we come to the pretrial statement of the appellees here. And again, as in the complaint, the referendum wasn't mentioned in the complaint or the possibility of having it. It wasn't mentioned in their pretrial statement. The pretrial statement was just the one that I just read you. It was all aimed at the state of Florida. And so at the hearing before Judge Arno, they asked each one of the commissioners, they each testified as to why they favored at large rather than single-member districts. And the general purport of it was the problems are at large, and so therefore the cure must be at large. And they
found expressly the contrary.
Pardon?
The district court said that wasn't so. Said that was inconsistent in with the manner in which the county commission actually operates.
Well, now
whose word are we supposed to take?
What that one commissioner, Commissioner Beck, testified that he went out and selected roads to be fixed and all that kind of thing. Chairman Kelson and Deese and the others said they operated countywide, and even Beck said he operated countywide. So that is picking out one statement that one of the commissioners made.
But the district court did say, and I quote him, that this position, your position, does not stand four square with the present operation of the commission and its business. That's what the district court said.
I didn't hear.
It said this, this explanation for at-large elections, the district court said, uh-huh, does not stand four square with the present operation of the commission and its business.
Well, I think that is an erroneous statement.
With that finding,
that's
that
an erroneous statement by the district court. So then we go to the he held that on the consideration of the charter, that the commissioners had all testified that they kept 5 for good government reasons, he also pointed out that they filed a post-trial memorandum in which they said that they wanted to keep the 5 to protect the incumbency. Court of Appeals, when they got that, they said they had read the entire testimony. They found no evidence whatever of racial motivation on the part of the commissioners, and that protecting one's incumbency didn't mean blacks qua blacks. and so therefore reversed. They did grant a rehearing. They did grant comments only on the Rogers versus Lodge, and not a rehearing at all. And in doing so, they decided that the Rogers versus Lodge was different from White versus Register and Whitcomb versus Chavis. Other cases like Mobile versus Bolden, therefore had given them a broader way to uphold, give greater deference to the finding of district courts. And they said, we're not taking back our statement about the incumbency, and they didn't take back their statement about having read all the evidence and found no racial motivation. They said they considered a broader range of evidence. The broader range of evidence was all of this discriminatory action by the state over the past 100 years. Their brief over and over again talks about the discrimination, the black crow laws, the poll tax laws, the white supremacy primaries, and all those things, Mr. Justice Marshall, for the past 100 years, the discrimination against blacks throughout Florida, and they didn't tie that into Escambia at all.
Mr. Ryan, and so, can I interrupt with a question? What do you understand the constitutional issue to be?
The constitutional issue is equality.
No, but I mean, let me put it a little differently.
Treated equally in the electorate.
Well, I understand that. What do you suppose the case turns on? Does it turn on whether one or more members of the commission had the wrong kind of motivation? Is that the whole case?
I don't think so. I think that...
What do they have to prove to win, in your view?
I think that we had to prove that...
No, what do they have to prove to win?
Oh, they had to prove that they were discriminated against, that they didn't get a full and fair opportunity at the polls. Now, there was, as I say, they were 66%.
Well, do you think they just had to prove adverse effect on their voting?
Yes.
That's
point
all
nine,
they had to prove?
Of them were registered.
Well,
so
I understand.
I'm
trying to understand the theory of the case is what
yes.
I'm trying to. And I'm trying to, first of all, understand what you understand their burden to be. What did they have to prove?
They had to prove that there were some racial reasons to keep them from the polls now, and from them having equality.
Racial reasons held by whom? You say, I take it, the state's racial reasons would be irrelevant.
Well, I think they had to prove that held by the people in Escambia.
Now, by that, do you mean the five commissioners or the voters?
The five commissioners and... the state itself, since everything was run by the state.
Well, you say they had to prove that there was discriminatory animus on the part of the state and all five commissioners, three commissioners, or one commissioner. What is your view?
There were only four of them at the time this came along, so...
Well, what do you think they had to prove? That's what I'm trying to find
out. Well, they had to prove some racial discrimination against them that prevented them from having an equal vote. That they didn't have equal access to the nominating and election proceedings. And
Well, we know what the voting was. Does the subjective state of mind of anybody make any difference?
The projected state
subjective, of mind... Subjective. The actual motivation of any individuals. Does that make any difference in the outcome of the case?
Well, I would say that it did. I think to show the one difference, at least, the legislative committee came along and proposed a new referendum, which...
Well, I understand it's your position that there was no adverse, you know, wrongful motivation. I'm just trying to understand what your legal theory is as respects what they had to prove in order to prevail.
They had to prove that the... A state itself, which put this system in, maintained it, and operated did so for racial discrimination.
And if they prove
purposes
that,
in Escambia.
And if they prove that, are they entitled to prevail?
Yes.
That means we don't have to examine the motivation of the county commissioners, if I understand.
Well,
you.
I think that's a part of it, but you don't have any racial discrimination in Escambia at all. And so I think that they had to
show. But I understand you to be conceding they don't have to prove any in Escambia either.
Pardon? Yes, they do. Yes. They have to prove that the...
It seems to me you've given me two or three different answers to... Do they or do they not have to prove that members of the county commission were prejudiced against black citizens?
Yes.
They do have to prove.
Yes.
And how many commissioners do they have to prove had that kind of motivation?
Well, I would say they had to prove that a majority of them. Yes. And I think, though, that this case, and I hope when the court thinks about it, really turns on the jurisdictional point that the state controlled everything and that the Escambians had nothing to say about it. There was no complaint from anybody about the polls and about voting, no impediments whatever, no complaints about the services rendered, no complaints about access. All the complaints were related to the state.
Mr. Menifee.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I would like to discuss the merits of the case. There are two substantive issues, one involving decision on liability and the second involving the decision on the remedy. First, concerning the decision on liability, we contend that the judgment should be affirmed under the doctrine of Pullman Standard v. Swent and Rule 52 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The district court made an intensely local appraisal, and the district judge lived in the community, and on the basis of that concluded that the at-large election system had both the purpose and effect of diluting black voting strength, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. The district court had before it substantial evidence, which in summary showed the following. First, historically, the election structure had been manipulated at every opportunity to minimize black participation. Second, the two charter study committees in 1975 and 77, which has been referred to in Mr. Ryan's statement, had both made recommendations for single-member districts, and the rejection of those recommendations was taken for the purpose of continuing the dilution of black voting strength. Third,
when you say rejection, Mr. Bob, who, rejection by whom?
The county commission rejected the recommendations of the charter study commissions.
And you say that the record supports the finding that the reason for their rejecting this recommendation was racially motivated.
We believe that, yes, the district judge's conclusion that that motivation was infected with discriminatory animus is supported. Yes, sir.
May I ask you the same question I asked your opponent?
Yes, sir.
How many people voted against who participated in this decision on the commission?
It's my understanding that both times it was a unanimous decision by the county commission.
And would it be sufficient to establish your case to prove that two people had the wrong kind of motivation?
Your Honor, I don't think it is.
What if one of them came in and frankly testified that he wanted to preserve white supremacy in the county? Would that be enough?
I believe under existing case law that's correct.
That it would be enough?
Yes, sir.
Do you interpret the district court as having found anything more than that?
More than one person?
Yes.
I don't believe the district court is clear how many. I don't believe it identified the number of actors. I believe it did identify the actors, and I believe it did it in a contextual sense of a long history of similar decisions being made in regard to county government in particular and other contemporary events that the district judge lived in that community and saw with regard to the city government change and to the school board change that also took place at the same time.
Well, you contend, if I understand your brief correctly, that even if none of the five had the wrong kind of motive, that still the state practices were sufficient to condemn the plan. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, I believe so. I believe it would be. And if I misunderstood your question from the beginning, I thought the question was what was shown, and I believe
well,
it was shown.
Very, very frankly, I think it's important to know when we say there's an invidious purpose, whose purpose we're talking about and how much, how many people we have to, I think the law is unclear, and I'm trying to find out what the record in this case is and what the parties are contending. That's
yes, sir.
Mr. Menefee, if the district court only found that the commissioners failed to recommend a single-member district plan to the voters, why should the remedy by the court be anything other than telling them to submit it to the voters?
It is a continued maintenance of the at-large election system. It was not merely a failure. It was indeed a rejection or overturning, if you will, would be the way I would prefer to cast
it. Well, if the offense was simply not submitting it to the voters, I don't know why the remedy wouldn't flow from that.
Justice O'Connor, I think what it shows, and put in this long historical record that is in this case, and I don't believe has been in another case before this court, every time the elections, there was an opportunity for blacks to participate in the election system, the system changed to minimize their participation. This is the most recent example. Put in that context, this was a continued maintenance of the discriminatory system.
What happened in the most recent election under the new plan? Was a black elected?
Yes. And for a black was elected for the first time in recorded history. Six black candidates sought election, 150% more than it had ever sought election to Escambia County Commission in all of history. It was a significantly different election. Black voter turnout was substantial.
Is the case now moot because of the withdrawal of the district court order, in your view?
I believe the remedy issue is probably moot. I'm a little concerned about the using the precise term. I believe the remedy issue is moot. I believe the liability issue is alive, with the exception of the pending motion for dismissal. I don't believe that. I don't believe the court has addressed that question.
Do I correctly read the district court as resting its conclusion of law upon a violation of amended Section 2 of the Civil Rights Act?
No, Your Honor. The district court.
May I ask, what I'm looking at is at 101A of the appendix. Respecting 42 U.S.C. 1973, the court concludes that the plaintiffs have established claims for relief under this section. Was that the finding of liability? Not on the constitutional ground, but on that.
The district court found liability under the unamended Section 2.
Yes.
And under 14th and 15th Amendments.
Under both.
Yes. The Court of Appeals
never addressed the statutory.
Never addressed the statutory, and only found on the 14th Amendment.
Well, ordinarily, I think courts address statutory grounds before they address the Constitution.
The election, well, there's a long footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion about why they would not ask for further briefs to address the recently amended Section 2 claim. And quite candidly, this case is perhaps in some way almost a dinosaur. I mean, the amended Section 2 is not here. I really believe that what this court's going to see in the future will be cases coming under the amended Section 2. I don't believe
this. Well, don't you rest on the amended Section 2?
Your Honor, yes. We believe the court could reach that. We have not briefed it. And we filed our complaint under Section 2, and we believe the amended Section 2...
Is a fortiori?
Yes. We would prevail on that, whether this court wants to consider it or whether... If you want further briefing and send it back to the Court of Appeals to address that issue, however that may be
handled. Liability is dilemma. What do you mean by that? Did you sue for damages?
No, sir. I just meant the initial.
What is a liability that's still open?
I don't believe, no. In my opening statement, I only meant to address a violation or not of the 14th Amendment.
Then I ask you, what is now open?
Before this court is that question of
what question?
The question of whether or not the 14th Amendment was violated, and whether or not the at-large election system denies equal protection of the law. We believe the remedy issue is moot.
Are you talking about the order that's been withdrawn? What order is now denying your people any rights?
The order that I understand is before the court is the judgment from the Court of Appeals that reached both the liability and remedy. We think subsequent events have mooted the remedy question. We think the remedy issue, the liability issue, is still before the court.
And what remedy do you want?
We want affirmance from and continuation,
well,
if you will,
of what?
Of the district court's remedial order. District court's
judgment. Is that the one that's been withdrawn?
We're affirming the Court of Appeals. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is where we stand.
But why do you think the remedy order is moot?
Because of the subsequent. I hate to use the term mootness, maybe slightly more technical, but I'm willing to go.
Did the district court withdraw its order?
No, Your Honor, it did not withdraw its order. It wasn't even before the district court to withdraw in that sense. The 1980 census came out. A new districting plan had to be fashioned. The county commissioners submitted another plan. The new plan had different boundaries, was considered and rejected. The 5-2 plan was rejected for different reasons than the reasons that are before the court for this, and it's presently pending before the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit.
And why do you think there's anything left of the case? I mean, I'm not just talking
just,
about the remedy.
Just, I'm overly cautious, perhaps. On the remedy issue, I don't...
Well, what about, you say, liability? Why is there anything left of that?
I think this court could determine that the decision below is erroneous. It's accepted all of the arguments and vacate all of the orders below and order reestablishment of the at-large election system. Now, that does not reach the question of whether the appeal can be maintained by the two minority members of the commission.
If we disagreed with the Court of Appeals and said there was no intentional discrimination, there never should have been a disestablishment of the at-large election system, the new election would be beside the point.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. The Section 2 issue would still remain.
I agree with you.
Then the 1980 redistricting was... And the adoption of the single-member districts under the 1980 plan was under somewhat of the force of the district court's order in this case.
That's correct. After the Court of Appeals issued its opinion and the mandate issued, the district court asked for new plans in light of the 1980 census and for a schedule of elections.
By the same token, the three new commissioners are a product of what is claimed to have been an illegal election. Or an illegal system.
Yes, sir. Without quibbling over the illegality term, yes, sir. I guess that would be their position. I don't want to argue this case for them. But
Mr. Manavi, you just said the Section 2 issue would remain. Since the Court of Appeals never addressed the Section 2 issue, am I correct?
Yes,
that's
correct.
It went to the constitutional issue.
That's correct.
Why don't we follow what quite often we will do? When we tell courts of appeals they ought to address statutory before they reach constitutional issues, why don't we send it back and tell them, you said the Section 2 issue at least is still in the case. Well, let them decide.
We believe the case is so strong we'd be glad for you to go ahead and rule in our favor on the constitutional issue, but certainly that is a common practice of the court.
Are we then asking the Court of Appeals to issue an advisory opinion? What else is there but an advisory opinion?
Well... Because of the, I understand.
We can't issue advisory opinions. I don't see how we can tell the Court of Appeals.
Because of the established practice of desiring a decision on statutory rather than constitutional grounds, that may warrant that practice. The other principal evidentiary facts that will.
You want the single-member district system to stay in place.
Yes, sir.
And if you lose this case, it may not stay in place.
That's correct.
If we reverse the Court of Appeals.
If you reversed on constitutional law,
then you're back
some
to
way
square one. You're back to square one when you started this lawsuit.
That's right, sir. Continuing at the list of the evidentiary factors that are in this record, There's a massive record of racially polarized voting. It is my best judgment that over 200,000 groups of data were entered into the computer for the 168 regression analyses. No black has ever won election to Escambia County until the elections this past fall under the single-member district plans. There is substantial evidence of socioeconomic disparity between black and white citizens. There are evidence of significant barriers to black candidate recruitment, black voter turnout, and black political participation. Also, this system features numbered place and majority vote requirements, which have no rational basis other than to protect the entrenched majority. Briefly address the...
When you say protect the entrenched majority, I think the Court of Appeals spent some time on this, that several of the commissioners voted against the new plan because of their desire to preserve their incumbency. I didn't see that that was necessarily a racial factor at all. I mean, they might well have wanted to preserve their incumbency against blacks or whites.
I don't think that factor standing as it... I agree with you in that, to that extent, Justice Rehnquist. That statement of, I want to protect my incumbency, I can't say that that is racially motivated. I think the problem the district court found is that the statements were inconsistent. They did not stand four square with the operation of the county. It wasn't a very credible performance. So that was, their proffered reasons were disbelieved. The district court had not only the testimony of those four commissioners, members of those charter government study committees testified, the transcripts of public hearings were before the district judge, and the final reports of those study committees were there.
But I thought either the district court or the Court of Appeals, and I can't remember which, puts some weight in putting together this discriminatory calculus on the fact that they thought the commissioners were against the plan for single-member districts because the commissioners wanted to hang on to their jobs.
Well, that factor is discussed, I believe, in both opinions, prominently also in the district court opinion. But I don't think either of the courts equated the desire to maintain incumbency with that direct racial. It's not a straight linear equation, if you will, with the racial animus. It is a contextual thing of the incredible testimony or lack of credible testimony that the commissioners gave, the testimony from the other witnesses that took the stand that were served on this committee, the written reports, the public transcripts, the actions taking place in the city and the school board near the same time, long historical evidence, and then the whole line of indicia that the court considered in Rogers v. Lodge. The line of indicia that's come down from White v. Register through Rogers v. Lodge, the polarized voting, lack of black candidates, socioeconomic disparity, and that sort of thing. And all of that's in this record, plus this historical, both, if you will, ancient historical and contemporary evidence of intent.
May I ask, just to refresh my recollection, is there a residency requirement in the... For the five commissioners, just the numbered polls?
Yes, there was a residency. There is a residency requirement attached with the at-large system. They had five residency sub-districts.
There's sort of an inconsistency between running a government, say it's a community-wide thing, and also a local district. Is there any explanation of why they have that specific combination?
Not in the record. The only explanation I've ever heard is, as has been referred to in opinions, so everybody can't live on the same block. But that's the very inconsistency that the district judge focused on when he heard these commissioners talk about how they'd go back into their district, and they called it their district, and see about their neighbor's road and repair this bridge or what have you, and then run at large and take an oath under the Florida Constitution to represent the entire county.
When the During the period that the white primary was enforced, the primary voting was that by district or at large?
That, as the district court called it, anomalous situation. From approximately the turn of the century, after most of the disenfranchising devices had taken effect, blacks were removed from the electorate. Then they went to this situation where the all-white Democratic primary was conducted from single-member districts. But the general election, which and my part of the country didn't mean a whole heck of a lot back then, was conducted at large. They'd let black folks vote in the general election, but not in the single-member district Democratic primary, which was the effective, the election that really counted. There are three principal historical eras, if you will. From the Civil War to the turn of the century, blacks were allowed to vote. They were registered, and in some North Florida counties constituted a majority of the voters. The fear of perhaps black getting elected and holding a county commission or school board office, they didn't even hold elections then. They had them by gubernatorial appointment because the state of Florida was majority white. Then, once blacks were disfranchised, the turn of the century, they went to this anomalous system of single-member district primary elections and at-large general elections. Then, World War II, veterans return, black veterans return, and want to participate in government. Smith v. Allwright strikes down the all-white Democratic primary, and the rules of the game are changed again. This time, they abolish the single-member district Democratic primaries and go to the at-large Democratic primaries. So that those three major historical shifts, put in the context with the manipulation, if you will, of these charter government study committee reports, the very specific contemporary evidence of a similar change in the city of Pensacola government in 1959 and the school board of Escambia County in 1976. That's the contextual arena that the district judge had to made this finding of intent. And that doesn't even touch the polarized voting, lack of black candidates, no blacks having ever been elected, the other factors that this court has referred to in other opinions. I would note some of the other evidence in the record. I've mentioned the substantial record on polarized voting, approximately 168 regression analysis. Not only did this measure the polarized voting and produce scatter diagrams for all of those elections, we also ran a test to measure voter turnout. This was confirmed by other studies, and it showed that blacks turned out at a rate of approximately half that of white voters. And this, we think, is a significant measure of black political participation. It's one thing to have a voter registration drive and urge people to go down and get their names at the polls, but the degree that people are hooked into the political system, the degree that they vote and participate, political scientists call it political socialization. I grew up in a house where my parents sat around the table and we would talk politics and you had a duty to go vote. That's essentially been an institution that has not been present, as present, in the black community. And it hasn't been present because blacks haven't been seeking office or candidates who have addressed the interest of black citizens haven't been seeking office. And we did run tests on some white candidates who had, generally they were presidential candidates or outside of Escambia County jurisdiction. The same phenomena occurs. In many cases, black voters will go to the poll, and if there's a candidate that has addressed their interest, they will vote in that race. But contrary to the behavior of most white voters, they will not pull the lever on all those other races that are on the ballot. And that's what these social scientists, or whatever, are talking about in terms of political socialization. How involved are you in the system? Have you had the opportunity to work on a campaign or get involved with see that your interests are at stake? It's like, I believe, Justice Marshall referred to in Bolden v. City of Mobile, casting meaningless ballots. And I'm afraid that that's the way most of the black voters in Escambia County, Florida, view their situation under the at-large
system. Mr. Menefee, it's not your position, I take it, that at-large elections are per se invalid.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Tell me this. I've never been to your county. In some counties in Florida, you have very substantial Spanish-American citizens. Do you have those in your county?
I don't know the exact figure, but no, it's a small portion of the population, I think less than 1 or 2%.
If you had the same percentage of Spanish-American citizens, would they be entitled to a separate district?
Well, I think there are a number of problems. with the disclaimer, that's not part of our case, but proceeding beyond that to address it. Yes, sir. Certainly, Mexican-American citizens, like all citizens, can assert a claim under the 14th Amendment. In formulating a remedy, I think this court has wisely adopted a policy of favoring single-member districts. It's a simple, straightforward method. If there are residential concentrations, if it has been shown that Mexican-Americans have been excluded from the political process over a period of time, substantial period of time, we're not talking about an episodic event that occurs once, we're not talking about India, then yes, if they've stated a claim, I mean, if they've come forward and joined in the litigation, I'm not sure of the full range of your hypothetical, Justice Powell. But.
Well, I know that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is not here, but as I understand that section, we've never interpreted it, but my understanding of it is that discriminatory intent is irrelevant. What counts is the effect, so that the effect would be the same under that section.
Section 2 has
so
a dual...
So if you had, just to carry it a little farther, what puzzles me about this whole area of the law is how far it may be carried. Majority voting in the United States has always been the norm. Suppose you had 19% of Orientals and so on down the road. Are we going to fractionate indefinitely the population to that extent?
Those are difficult questions, and I don't believe that they have to be
addressed. We don't have to be answered today.
Today, thank goodness. Section 2 does have either purpose or effect. So you can prevail under either standard under the amended Section 2. But I think the fundamental question is fair and effective representation. And as this court has had to deal with since Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims, fair and effective representation has, in those cases, focused on a numerical figure of maximum deviation from an ideal district. Well, every citizen has a right to that, and it is just as possible to gerrymander districts by having one giant district, having five smaller districts, or even as one plan that was submitted and I think later withdrawn early in this litigation by the county, we called it the Bantustan plan. Proposed having one district in the middle of the county that would be black and the other four commissioners would be elected at large from the rest of the county. That plan was withdrawn, perhaps after we named it the Bantustan plan after the South African homelands. But these systems can all be manipulated. It is as much a political decision to have an at-large system as it is to have district system, and as much a political decision as to how the district lines would be drawn. So we have had, this court has developed a long line of cases from the one person, one vote concept, and has had a rather easily manageable standard, judicially manageable standard of numerical equality. But black citizens have a strong claim for protection under the 14th Amendment, and what this case shows is that at-large election systems can have and has had in this case for many, many, many years, far more than a decennial census, the opportunity to dilute the vote of a minority, to deny it equal protection under the laws. No further questions. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Ryan? You have only 1 minute remaining.
In that 1 minute, I want to say that all of the matters that he was referring to of discrimination were state action and not action by Escambia County.
Now, Mr. Santuri, are you prepared? Does your constituency wish to be heard on the oral argument to dismiss the case?
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, may it please the court. Florida law is clear that a county has no voice, can take no act, except as directed by the Board of County Commissioners. In this particular instance, an election was held, the composition of the Board of County Commissioners has changed. What had previously been a unanimous decision to carry forward the appeal on this matter has now changed. A majority of the Board of County Commissioners voted in a legal meeting to dismiss this appeal.
And although the present majority is owes its office to the fact that the court imposed the single-member district plan, does it not?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that is a yes, but it's a qualified yes. The former members, that is all five members of the Board of County Commissioners, and we have a five-member system in Escambia County, they were only in office but for the fact that the elections had been stayed. Those elections probably would have been heard or would have been had well before 1983 but for the order.
On
an at-large basis, yes. And I might point this out to the court, that all the incumbents ran on a platform that was constituted of or consisted of saying that they intended to maintain this lawsuit. And all except for one was defeated. The three of the majority members, they made it a very strong point that they had had enough of this lawsuit and they thought Escambia County had, and they wanted to withdraw it. Now, I did mention that a majority of the Board of County Commissioners voted. Florida does not recognize majority-minority positions on its Board of County Commissioners. There is one position of the Board of County Commissioners. And
to decide that position, must it not?
That is correct, Mr. Chief Justice. The majority must, but the Board
does. So there is a position of the County Commissioners before the court now, today.
That is correct.
And that position is to dismiss the appeal.
Yes, sir, to dismiss the appeal. Florida law is clear that an individual member of the Board of County Commissioners has no authority.
Well, what you say would make a great deal more sense to me if you're talking about an orthodox appeal where the county, say, had a money judgment against it. Or do we appeal from the district court to the 11th Circuit? Do we appeal to the Supreme Court of Florida? And then a new group of commissioners is elected. They say, this lawsuit just isn't worth what it's costing us. Let's give up the appeal. Surely the county ought to have the final say in that. But here, in effect, if the principle you're contending for is correct, the district court could impose a perfectly outrageous redistricting plan on Escambia County, put it into effect. The new commissioners all come into office by virtue of that plan. When they get in, they vote to abandon the appeal, so that in effect the district court's judgment is never reviewable.
Justice Rehnquist, I think it is. There is a vehicle. There is a legal means by which this election can be attacked. But in this particular case, the position we're at now with all the parties being realigned or misaligned, I don't think that the correct pleadings are before this court to...
That the case is moot?
As Mr. Menfee said, I hate to go into to use that term mootness. I'm just concerned about the underlying court decisions and what effect it may have if this court, or if we were to urge it, be dismissed as moot.
I think if you're going to say it's moot, why, we would vacate the judgment of the Court of Appeals, direct the Court of Appeals to remand it to the district court with instructions to dismiss the entire case. And if the case isn't moot, I don't know what business we got dismissing it.
What I would suggest is that the persons that are attempting to maintain the suit do not have the requisite interest in this particular case.
Didn't the district court... aren't the individual commissioners, old commissioners, were parties?
That is correct.
And it was maintained in their individual capacity, not just their official capacity. Those two are still members of this, still parties to this lawsuit.
Justice...
Aren't they?
Justice White, that is correct. That is correct.
All right. So apparently somebody, like the district judge, thought they had an interest in their individual capacity, wholly aside from their position as commissioners.
Well, I'm bound by what the judge found and what is in the record. And as you probably noted in the supplemental brief as filed by the appellees, there was an excerpt from Judge Arnold's order. And he stated that his only reason for keeping them in there was not for any liability that they faced as far as cost, attorney's fees, or any individual liability. He only left them in order that he could enforce his injunctions against them personally in the event that the Board of County Commissioners was to take a position contrary to his orders.
Well, hasn't he got a, haven't those two got a, got some interest in having the injunction, if it's outstanding against them, lifted? I would, and I would think you wouldn't like to be under some injunction if it were illegal, would you?
That is correct, however.
Well, why is the case moot then? If you want to say it's moot, you ought to say it's moot. Then we can get rid of these judgments.
I do believe the mootness issue was addressed in the appellee's brief.
Well, your position, as I understand, isn't that it's moot. It's that you are the party that at one time you represent the party that sought to challenge the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit's judgment. Your client has now changed its mind. It no longer wants to challenge the Court of Appeals judgment.
That is correct.
That doesn't mean it's moot. It just means you want to give up the petition.
We're tired of the lawsuit, in other words, and we want to withdraw.
Well, all you want is dismiss the appeal of this court, period.
That's correct. I don't want to go.
And let's stand everything that happened below.
That is correct, Your Honor.
The thing is, you don't happen to represent the two individual commissioners.
I represent the Board of County Commissioners.
Yes, well, they have two individual commissioners who are parties in their own right.
But we're saying that they do not have the requisite interest in this particular case to force the county to keep pursuing the appeal.
Well, to pass on the issue that you've raised, the court would have to decide whether these two have any interest to preserve.
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chief Justice.
Yes, it would be a nice thing if that's really an issue. I suppose we could remand this to the Court of Appeals for two or three reasons. One, to consider your point first. Secondly, if there's still a live case, reconsider the matter under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
A remand may be the correct vehicle in order to. There are some factual assertions that have been made through the supplemental briefs, and that may be the appropriate
vehicle. And it may be that the Court of Appeals couldn't solve it. It would have to remand it to the District Court.
That is correct, Justice White.
May I ask, in your opinion, whom does Mr. Ryan represent?
Justice Stevens, I believe that he has named Commissioner Dixon, Commissioner Kelson, and he represents also certain former members of the Board of County Commissioners.
He certainly made it clear he thinks there's something he wants to fight about still.
I believe he did state that position, Mr. Justice.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Chief
Thank
Justice.
You,
I appreciate
the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in